Welcome to the Public Morality. Candidate Joe Biden offered the prospects of a democracy summit, an international gathering of Democratic leaders. But when January 6th occurred, and suddenly it seemed for many this was not the right time for a democracy summit, at least not one that the United States should be hosting. Global footage of rioters violently invading the Capitol in what appeared to be a reenactment of Shay's Rebellion or storming the Bastille did not appear to be an example of popular sovereignty at its finest. January 6th seemingly put an end to the prospects of the United States hosting a democracy summit. But my guest, Stuart Patrick, in a recent article for World Politics Review, holds a contrarian perspective. He argues the events of January 6th demonstrated democracy summit is needed now more than ever. Stuart is the James H. Binger Senior Fellow in Global Governance and Director of the International Institutions and Global Governance Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stuart Patrick, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thank you so much, Byron. Great to be here.
When I hear the prospects of a democracy summit, my first question is, what are we talking about? How is democracy defined? And is that merely purple ink-stained fingers? I mean, what came to your mind when you first heard candidate Biden talk about a democracy summit?
Yeah, it's a fair question, Byron. And I think in a lot of people's mind, when they think of democracy, that's what they thought. Certainly when we were in, the United States trying to bring democracy to Iraq, that was really the symbol. But it's a lot more than that. I mean, the way I think of democracy is, it's obviously a system of representative government, which is based on this fundamental principle that, political legitimacy or political authority derives its legitimacy from the consent of the governed. Now, I mean, when you think about it, there's obviously lots of different democracies around the world, right? We have parliamentary democracies like in the United Kingdom. We have presidential democracies, and we even have, and obviously there are constitutional monarchies. But all democracies basically have, I think, some fundamental characteristics. One, of course, is free and fair elections, but not only elections, but there's a prospect that you're actually going to get a peaceful transfer of power from one regime to another. You have guarantees of equality under the law. You have some protections of fundamental political rights, and particularly civil and political rights, like those that are in the Bill of Rights, like freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, right to trial by jury. You've also got normally in a successful democracy some constraints on the tyranny of the majority in the forms of checks and balances. And you've got separation of powers, particularly an independent judiciary, right, so that like an executive or a legislature couldn't run amok. And then finally, the general principle is you have the primacy of the rule of law over the rule of man or the rule of men or women. And that's a really important principle, that nobody is above the law.
Now, if there were to be a democracy summit fostered by President Biden, would that include Argentina, Colombia, and Brazil, which, my words, right now are democracies in name only?
Yeah, it might well include those. They might be on the invitation list. Some people have suggested that if President Biden were to do this, that there might be a steering group that determines some, if not qualifications, at least requires some commitment, some stated commitment to general principles to be able to be there. All of them, I think, would be considered democracies, given the fact that they've had, in recent years, peaceful transfers of power from one group to another. But I think particularly in the case of Brazil, you'd have to think of these as a deeply flawed democracy, because it's, it has a populist, really authoritarian government that's moved more to the right under Jair Bolsonaro. All three of those countries, that's Argentina, Colombia, and Brazil, they all have pretty high levels of corruption. And at least a couple of them, Brazil, but particularly Colombia, have dealt with issues of impunity, including in Colombia's case for sort of the long, crimes committed during the long civil war in that country.
You actually use the term flawed democracy, and the Economist Democracy Index rated all of those the aforementioned as flawed democracies. But the United States is also included in that flawed democracy category. And given that rating, is the United States the proper nation to host a democracy summit?
You know, that is a question that a ton of people are answering. You know, there's no question that the credibility of the U.S. to host such a summit has really been weakened. I mean, I would argue that it's stronger after January 20th. I think the United States kind of had a near-death experience there because it was unclear to me whether or not democracy would have survived in its in the form that we've seen it if Donald Trump had had a second term, given the fact that he was hollowing out a lot of the institutions that are at the basis of American democracy. But I don't think we're out of the woods. The sheen is really off American exceptionalism, this notion that which most Americans have believed in. The United States has this sort of special role, by providence, to sort of, lead the world. And it's off both in the United States, at least among Democrats who are more skeptical of that view, and it's off amongst foreign observers as well. Before Donald Trump, the major debate about U.S. and democracy was, well, should we be a beacon for democracy, right? Just do our own thing and everybody else could sort of look up to us. Or should we be a crusader for it? And I think today the big question is, can we do either of those things? Well before the insurrection on January 6th, the Trump years, in my view at least, had exposed a lot of the weaknesses of American democracy, and also how deeply dependent American democracy is on a bunch of unspoken norms of presidential conduct, which the president violated. Now, in terms of whether or not the United States can still hold this thing, I think whether or not we can host the summit depends a lot on how we frame it. I think if President Biden frames it as, hey, we're not here to hector or lecture, but we're here to listen and learn. And, we recognize that we live in a glass house, the glassiest of glass houses. And that's kind of the message that actually President Biden delivered in his first foreign policy speech at the State Department. If he comes from a position of humility, that we're all vulnerable and we need to look at these sources of vulnerability and we're all trying to get to a more perfect union, I think he can bring this democracy summit off. But it is a exercise that's pretty fraught with danger, I think, for the president.
I'm going to come back to that, but I want to stay with this notion of democracy and specifically the Economist Index, because and thinking about the work that you do in that index, only 13% were rated as full democracies, 32% were flawed democracies, 22% were hybrid regimes, which I think is authoritarian by another name, and then 32% were authoritarian. So does this 13% full democracy, given the work that you do around the world, is that concerning to you in terms of the trajectory?
Absolutely. I'm not. I don't know that I would have figures that are quite as extreme as the Economist, but I mean, cause I'm not really sure about the methodology that they used. I tend to reference ratings from an organization called Freedom House, which is basically a global watchdog. And every year they publish something called Freedom in the World, assigning to 190 odd nations, basically to one of three categories: free, partly free, or not free. And in the most recent one from 2020, the percentage of free countries was about a little more than 42%, which still exceeded those that were deemed partly free, which is about 32%, and not free, 25%. So it's a plurality, right, that we're still free. But I have to say the trend, to get to your question, is not moving in freedom's direction. This, according to Freedom House, last year was the 14th straight year that democracy had receded around the world. And, political rights and civil liberties were deteriorating in about twice as many countries as they were improving. And in addition, Freedom House called attention to, now this was during the Trump administration, but huge deteriorations in, two of the world's biggest democracies, certainly the world's biggest democracy in the case of India, but then also in the United States as well under Donald Trump. So there's no question that democracy is on the ropes. And I should probably give you a little historic context.
Sure.
Here too. That is a huge, that is a huge far cry from like the early Cold War. You might remember that when Bill Clinton was in the White House, the big theme of the national security strategy that they came out with, I think in 1994, was basically, trying to promote the enlargement and expansion of the world's community of market democracies. And it was seen as inevitable that this was going to occur. Flash forward 10 years and you got George W. Bush, his entire thing, and this might have been hubris, was, hey, we've got to promote you know, the non-negotiable demands of human dignity worldwide. Unfortunately, some of the nation-building exercises in the global war on terrorism sort of gave some, and regime change gave democracy promotion a bad name there. And I think it really cratered, though, under the Trump administration.
Hmm. You touched on it earlier, but I'd like to come back to it. You talked about American exceptionalism and talk about what it is. But as I recall reading Democracy in America by de Tocqueville, he said America was exceptional, but not for the reasons you just defined. It actually was a slap. So what is American exceptionalism, and how is it viewed on the international stage?
Yeah, American exceptionalism is the view that that the United States, by virtue of the founding principles, its founding principles that are in the Declaration and then the Constitution of the United States, by virtue of those, it has sort of a special role to play and a special status in the world. Now, how American exceptionalism is applied has varied greatly. For some folks, it's meant across U.S. history. For some folks, it's meant, hey, you know, we have this unique experiment that is, in fact, superior to the way a lot of other countries organize themselves. And so basically, but it's in danger of, and so sometimes American exceptionalism is used to justify isolation from an alien world that might otherwise corrupt it. So, you know, you see exceptionalism you invoke that way. At other times, like in the time of Woodrow Wilson, you know, who wanted to make the world safe for democracy, the idea was, hey, we got to be this crusader nation that goes out there and transforms the world into our image. So it's basically a sense that the United States has a special destiny among countries. But the question is, how do we actually translate that? Of course, these days, a lot of people are asking how special the United States is. Don't we still have a lot of the same problems a lot of other countries do?
Well, when you mention that, I think if we're going to be fair historically, I mean, wouldn't we say that this whole notion of democracy in the United States has been flawed? And I'm not saying that in the economist sense, but we've struggled with the inclusivity of the preamble, we the people, and really sort of having tension with who exactly comprises the we. And that's sort of been an ongoing struggle for us as a country, has it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the United States has been, a flawed democracy since from the get-go in a lot of ways. When you begin a republic with the institution of slavery, you know, when we begin with African Americans being a fraction of quote-unquote human beings in the Constitution, you know, you have a flawed democracy from the get-go. And then you get into, you know, the failures of the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, Jim Crow laws, civil rights struggle, the ongoing battle against voter suppression, you know, and this is to say nothing of, you know, that struggle for women's suffrage, for gender equality, recent problems with anti-immigrant sentiment, you know, Islamophobia, et cetera. You know, this struggle is ongoing. The sort of more optimistic way of looking at it is that, you know, since our founding, we have been forever struggling to improve and expand our democracy, and that at least the Constitution provides certain principles, and other founding documents provide certain principles that allow for that expansion. And so that, you know, there's a sense of progressivism that goes along with that. But there's no question that, you know, the last few years have tried our optimism and our patience with the notion that things are going in a progressive direction, and you know, shows how much still needs to be fought for.
I'm speaking with Stuart Patrick about the Biden administration's proposed International Democracy Summit. Patrick is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stuart, let's drill down on your piece from the World Politics Review. You take a somewhat contrarian perspective, in the sense that for a number of people, January 6th became a reason not to hold a proposed democracy summit. You see it a different way. Explain.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people said, look, we are the last people that should be holding a summit for democracy when, you know, the Capitol was just ransacked and, you know, people were the insurrectionists were, roaming the halls of Congress, trying to string up Nancy Pelosi, kill Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and hang Mike Pence, the vice president. On what possible grounds could the United States have to hold a democracy summit? I guess what I mean is that, I think that the summit could work if it's really, depending how it's framed. I mean, it really has to be framed from a position of humility. I think that there's merit in having a gathering of democracies that both acknowledges our own deep flaws as a democracy, the fact that we're a work in progress, while still declaring, along with our democratic partners, look, democracy is a universal aspiration, universal relevance. It's not something that's culturally relative any more than fundamental human rights are. Again, I think you have to frame it as an effort to protect and improve the resilience of democracies from threats that are as much sort of internal. I mean, they're from within as much as they are from without. And, those threats include, the spread of corruption, the erosion of fundamental human rights, and, difficulties of inclusion, particularly of minority communities, rampant misinformation, which is not just a factor of sort of external interference, of course, but it's also the dilemmas of digital democracy, right? When you have this incredibly fragmented information environment and nobody agrees, or at least people do not, big portions of the country do not have the same agreement on what truth is anymore. I think that, those are general problems that confront the entire democratic world. And, it may be time to sort of circle the wagons amongst democracies and think about how we can collectively learn from each other about the best ways of battling those issues.
Mm. You also wrote in that piece that a democracy summit would come at a time when the United States has frittered away its historical standing as a leader in the democratic world. Did that begin 4 years ago, or was that something that's been ongoing in your view?
It's been ongoing, but it certainly got worse over the last 4 years during the Trump administration. It's obvious that the United States has always been selective in its promotion of democracy and human rights, as well as its practice at home. But the selectivity, I think, reached its apogee under the Trump years, which saw an incredibly cynical, let's just focus on foreign policy. I mentioned that, democracy promotion had to some degree been given a bad name under the sort of nation building exercises. But I think that Donald Trump was really the true aberration, because since 1945, there's been something like, before him, I guess there was, since FDR, there have been 13 administrations that have given rhetorical and often practical support to this notion that democracy is the way that the world, that the country should be governed, and that human rights should be defended. But Trump presided over a really cynical foreign policy. I mean, he told Bob Woodward, for instance, that, he says it's funny, the tougher and meaner the rulers of other countries are, the more I sort of respect them, and the more I feel close and affinity to them. And the list of autocrats and strongmen that Donald Trump cozied up to is really extraordinary. I mean, a short list would include, Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, Mr. Sisi in Egypt, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, Kim Jong-un in North Korea, and, a sort of a strongman in a democracy or quasi-democracy, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. So, you really have somebody who, and then, by the same token, called, democratic leaders like Angela Merkel of Germany, or Emmanuel Macron of France, considered them weak and called them out as such. So it's really quite remarkable the degree to which we elected a president who really had such authoritarian tendencies.
When I was listening to your answer, I was just thinking, it reminded me when I visited the Civil Rights Museum in Birmingham. And near the end of the exhibit, there's a number of newspapers around the world that had front page stories about the police dogs and fire hoses. And some of those were the Pravda, China, just some of the real authoritarian places. And so they sort of gloated at the notion that America is not the shining city on the hill. And I'm wondering, did we have that same, was that the same impact vis-a-vis January 6th?
Yeah, very much so, actually. You saw a lot of adversarial regimes making hay, you know, some trolling by the Venezuelan government, you know, basically, you know, almost suggesting that maybe, you know, we needed a little democracy assistance in our country and you know, some sort of, you know, sort of expressions of sympathy that we hope, you know, by the Chinese and others that they hope we get our, you know, governing house in order, that sort of thing, the Iranians as well. So absolutely. And just with reference to what you say about the sort of police dogs set loose on protesters in the 1950s, it was actually a serious issue in terms of U.S. credibility, because the United States obviously was engaged in a Cold War conflict and rivalry with the Soviet Union and its other members of the communist bloc. And there was no question that U.S. officials running foreign policy at the time thought that this was a major vulnerability on the part of the United States, how could we, on the one hand, say that we stood for universal human rights and yet obviously not extending them to our own population, particularly as, you know, a lot of, you know, brown-skinned people, frankly, around the world were trying to become independent from their colonial masters. And so it was a huge problem. The other issue, though, which remains the case today, and I should just say that's quite relevant for now, too, right? You know, mm-hmm. The fact that, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement has shown structural racism and inequalities in the United States certainly undermines, raised the question of whether or not we have a leg to stand on internationally. The other issue at the same time in the 1950s was that, and beginning in the 1950s, was that the United States remains really, really reluctant, partly because of the nature of Senate ratification, to actually ratify UN human rights treaties. And that was true in the 1950s, and it remains true today. And so it's easy to accuse the United States of hypocrisy because, you know, even sometimes when we've promoted a human rights treaty, we don't end up ratifying it globally because we have, partly because of the hurdles, as I said, of Senate ratification. But both of those things were true in the 1950s, and they're true today.
Well, one of the things you mentioned earlier, that if President Biden entered into a democracy summit with humility, which makes sense to me, I wonder, just given our politics and the fractured nature of our politics and sort of tying this to the Cold War, I mean, the Cold War sort of bound us. And it was sort of like that was the wall. You couldn't cross that wall. I mean, that was sort of bound
right,
us.
Right.
We're not bound that way anymore, as evidenced by former President Obama's apology tour, which he never apologized. But do you worry that if Biden were to show some contrition, that it gets transmuted into another apology tour?
Yeah, exactly. So that, you know, when, you know, I think absolutely. Yeah. And as you mentioned, you know, when President Obama was honest about some, American conduct in sort of previous years and decades abroad, you know, it was immediately, you know, tarred, particularly by his Republican enemies as being somehow un-American. And, you know, I think there's a serious danger here that if President Biden were to have convened this democracy or summit for democracy and sort of say, hey, the United States is a fragile democracy, too, that could be a real problem, particularly as long as the Republican Party remains, you know, basically captive to, you know, a nationalist, nativist and conspiracy minded base, you know, that has no trouble, frankly, in my view, flirting with fascism. I think that the Republican Party right now is deeply sensitive to basically any examination of some of the shortcomings in the history of the United States. And I think that, you know, you saw this towards the end of the Trump administration, right? You heard of this 1776 commission, right? This sort of like, you know, effort to kind of whitewash history and suggest that, you know, the United States is sort of a flawless creature, right? And I think that the fact that, you know, when you have one party that has no interest in turning, you know, a critical eye or even being reflective of some of the injustices and imperfections that have existed in the United States and that we've, you know, been struggling with over the course of our history, you got a problem. Because you end up with accusations like, why do you hate America, right?
Right.
So I would see, you know, one of the problems with this is it could become a major political football, right? I mean, ideally, you'd want to make any summit for democracy, you know, have some, you know, reasonable, constructive internationalist Republicans there. You know, unfortunately, John McCain is no longer with us. Maybe you could get Mitt Romney, but who else is going to be there to give it that kind of a flavor?
Mm. You know, when you mentioned 1776, I also teach a civics course, and we were talking just that very thing, and it seemed to me that the more apt historical comparison was not 1776, but 1886 to 87, that being Shays' Rebellion. That was more of a Shays' Rebellion moment, which scared the bejesus out of the founders more so than a 1776 moment.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point in terms of this particular episode.
Not long ago, we had UVA professor Barbara Perry on talking about President George H.W. Bush. And one of the things that she brought up was that President Bush, because of his long tenure, had the ability to get on the phone and talk with foreign leaders, and even when it wasn't an ask. In your view, I'm not saying he hasn't, but would you like to see President Biden doing something very similar with foreign leaders before he rolls out a democracy summit?
Oh, yeah, very much so. On Wednesday, the president met with, Thursday, the president gave his first foreign policy speech at the State Department. And, you know, he mentioned the number of world leaders that he has been talking to, and I'm sure that has probably come up in those conversations. You know, the European Union, at least at the Brussels level, has suggested that it would be in favor of this summit and wants to take part. And I think other countries will be interested. I think that it's really important that this not be simply a made in the USA exercise, because again, that gets you back to the image of, you know, the United States is, you know, lecturing and wagging a finger at the rest of the world. So I think that what some people have suggested is that there should be some kind of a steering committee that helps, you know, iron out the details of this. You know, deals with some of the serious problems, like who do you invite, right? And what happened, you know, where do you cut the guest list off? And so there could be some sort of a steering committee. Ideally, it would, for this democracy summit, ideally you'd have both established democracies, but then also from sort of the wealthy world, but then you'd also have some from the developing world that could help you, you know, give sort of an international sheen to this and suggest buy-in from countries other than just the United States.
You talked earlier about sort of the historical struggle that the United States has had in terms of extending democracy to people of color, to women, et cetera. And I'm wondering, is there any actual legislative work we need to do prior to such a summit, in your view? Because post the election of Joe Biden, you've had, I could be wrong about my numbers here, but you've had, what, roughly 28 states, state legislatures, sort of try to pull back on the ability to do mail-in voting, which is, again, attacking the franchise to make voting even more onerous for people. Is there anything that we, I don't know if we can do anything, but should we be looking in that, or should we just accept that as part of our flaws as a flawed democracy?
Well, you know, I think that we should be doing everything in our power to try to you know, influence state legislators that are attempting to do things like that, in addition to trying to, you know, use, say, their control of in the majority to try to do even more gerrymandering and efforts at voter suppression. You know, I think that those steps send a terrible message, right? They reinforce the impression that the United States, you know, is deeply divided, and that one of its two parties is basically anti-democratic, with small d, democratic. You know, the dilemma for President Biden, you know, if he holds this democracy summit, is going to be, you know, he's probably going to have to go beyond saying things like, hey, the United States is a flawed democracy, or it's just a work in progress, you know, but explicitly mention some of these actions being used to curtail the franchise. I think that citizen engagement and involvement, the kind of mobilization that you saw from, obviously, most famously from Stacey Abrams in Georgia, you know, efforts to try to overturn some of these more egregious steps by the courts, I think, are going to be very, very important. I think that, you know, ultimately, it's actually going to take, you know, getting some of these folks who are trying to engage in these anti-democratic behaviors out of office. I have some hopes that the demographic changes in the United States, they're ongoing, will hasten that, although one can't be too secure or confident about the direction that, you know, new voters will take.
You sort of alluded to this earlier, but American democracy at its core is really held together by an idea that was articulated in the Declaration of Independence. And that idea has withstood a civil war, a Great Depression, a civil rights movement, the Cold War. So when you look at where America is today, given that it's more than 300 million people plus, it's much easier to say what it means to be French or what it means to be German. Given that that divergent view, I mean, can we sustain ourselves as a democracy?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, time is going to tell about that. I tend to be optimistic. I mean, the history of the United States is of, in many ways, but one of aspects of its history is of integrating, you know, diverse peoples into sort of one American, you know, nation. But you know, you put your finger on something, which is that, you know, whereas, you know, at its best, the United States, the good thing about the United States is that it's not, hasn't been a people nation, right? It hasn't been one based on, you know, simple or basically on ethnicity. You know, one thinks about the Germans or the Japanese, for instance, but it's been less of a people nation in that regard than an idea nation, right? That, as you say, we've been based on this shared conception of political values. That and so there's some myth in that, but there's also some truth in it. The question is whether or not we can still do that. I think, you know, I don't want to make this in totally partisan terms, but I have to say that I think the future of the American democracy rests in a large degree in the future of the Republican Party and whether its leaders are able to and muster the courage to actually speak truth to their rank and file. I do think there have been previous eras in which the United States has experienced extremism. You think of the know-nothings in the mid-1800s who worried about, you know, Irish immigration and the influence of the Pope, you know, or the John Birch Society a century later, which is pretty rampant in the 1950s, but was ultimately expunged from the Republican Party. You know, I think we probably can surmount the current difficulties, but it's going to be harder, I think, because we have to navigate this really fragmented social media environment, which is just terrible for democracy because we all retreat to our own corners and echo chambers, right? I think there has to be some way of, you know, regulating or policing the big tech giants here, you know, that are where these platforms are without, you know, hopefully infringing on free speech. But because we need to get back to some sort of a national conversation, we need to invest in, you know, civic education, et cetera. But I also believe it's really important that political leaders are held accountable for their flirtations with authoritarianism, which I don't think we've seen recently.
You know, President Biden, in the aftermath, he was vice president-elect. I mean, he was president-elect, excuse me. And in the aftermath of January 6th, he says, it's not who we are. But one has to wonder if that's a true statement taken into account, you know, just January 6th, that has long there's been this gap, this declaration between our lived commitments and our actual practices. So in some ways, I guess I'm asking you, in some ways, for some, is January 6th a portion of who we actually are?
Yeah, you know, boy, it remains to be seen, you know, whether or not this is who we are or not. You know, Joe Biden also said we're better than this. And I think it's going to help that he's going to be turning down the volume. But I think we need a couple more electoral cycles, you know, to determine whether this is who we are or not. I do think that, you know, the events of January 6th, obviously, you know, put everybody into mind of, you know, looking at banana republics around the world. You know, and we're very, very lucky that the damage wasn't greater and that more people, including legislators, weren't killed. What's really extraordinary in the aftermath was to see people like Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, you know, to go to Mar-a-Lago and bend a knee to Donald Trump after he had incited this rebellion, you know, and then, you know, the entire Republican caucus, the vast majority, not really having the courage to criticize, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance, for her incendiary comments and her sort of QAnon philosophy. You know, on one level, you know, it's a small number of people who gathered at the Capitol and then stormed it, right? But what made it so dangerous was that it wasn't just anticipated, but that it was egged on by the sitting president of the United States. And that even after it was ransacked, we didn't get enough politicians bringing themselves to come out against the president who had done it. So, you know, I think that I'm glad Joe Biden is turning down the temperature, but I have to say it's too early to tell whether or not we're able to turn the corner on this and sort of get back to sort of the normal values, norms, and principles of what it means to be an established democracy and a stable one at that.
And my next question, I'm asking not just in the context of the United States, I'll use them as example, but it's broader to tap into the breadth of your work. Can you be a functioning democracy if one party is obstinate, my words, and at best the other party can be mediocre at best? Can you be a functioning party when one party, at least one party, just says no, we're not gonna adhere to the norms, the constitutional norms?
You know, I don't think you can, not for long. I think that there have been plenty of democracies that have had, you know, two relatively mediocre parties, you know, vying for power. I think a lot of the history of Great Britain has been between sort of unsatisfactory Labour and unsatisfactory Conservative parties, with a few other small parties thrown in there, you know, and certainly in the United States, there hasn't been perfection on either major political party, the past 150 years. But what I don't think that you can have is one of those two major parties not believe in or abide by the norms of democracy. I think the good news is that I don't know that that's sustainable for that party either. I think it sort of raises the question of whether there will be new blood within that party, because it can't simply also be obstructionist, or whether or not a splinter party emerges, and either, which has happened a couple of times in American politics, but not frequently, a splinter party emerges that either takes the position of that other party or forces one of those that major party to adapt to for electoral survival. The one hopeful thing, as I said before, that I see is that the demographic changes in the United States are, I believe, will be leading towards more inclusive politics and hopefully more respect for democracy along the way. Mm.
Stuart Patrick, Council of Foreign Relations, Senior Fellow, thank you, sir, for joining me today.
It's been a great pleasure.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, B-E-Y-R-O-N, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you receive your podcasts. Once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WJAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast The Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. In the words of Martin Luther King, we may have come on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. For all of us at The Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.